Hi again, everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the co-director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's. I'm joined again by my friend and colleague, Mark DiGirolami, the center's other co-director, for an episode of Legal Spirits, which is our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived on Apple iTunes, also at the Android site, and at our own website, lawandreligionforum.org. So how you doing, Mark? How are things up in Westchester?
I'm good. I'm excited for the 4th of July weekend, and it's a little rainy here, but looking forward to our podcast together.
Yeah, it's rainy here too, but it is the 4th of July weekend. I'm going to do my my traditional reading of The Devil and Daniel Webster, but I'll get to that tomorrow. It's my 4th of July tradition. So, well, we're very lucky today to have a guest with us on Legal Spirits. Our guest is Gerald Rosello, who is a big law partner in New York, where he focuses on securities enforcement and regulatory practice. But Gerald also has a second life, which is why we've invited him here today. He is the editor of the University Bookman, which is a book review journal that's part of the Russell Kirk Center for Cultural Renewal. University Bookman, and both Mark and I have written for it, actually. University Bookman is an invaluable resource for reviews, generally from a conservative perspective, on a wide variety of subjects, cultural subjects, literary subjects, and political subjects. In addition to editing the Bookman, Gerald is also an opinion writer of considerable reputation. He writes on subjects related to law, politics, and in particular, legal and political conservatism. He's authored pieces in the Wall Street Journal, in the LA Review of Books, in New Criterion, in Modern Age, and many other publications. And he also has a book to his name, The Postmodern Imagination of Russell Kirk, which was published by the University of Missouri Press. So Gerald is really a man of many and varied talents. One thing we might ask you about, Gerald, is how you managed to do all this. But most importantly, Gerald is a participant in the Tradition Project, which is the Center for Law and Religion's research project on the continuing value of tradition in law, politics, and culture. It's on a bit of a hiatus now, but Gerald was part of the project when it was underway a couple of years ago. So I'm going to turn it over now to Mark to introduce Gerald and get us started.
Terrific. Well, thank you very much. And let me add my welcome to Mark's, Jerry, for being with us. Both Mark and I are great admirers of your many projects, and we've been delighted and honored to contribute to the University Bookman. And we've kind of watched as you've been able to do all of the things that you do over the years in great admiration. So here's what we'll do. Here's our plan for today. First, we're going to give you a chance to tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into the work with the Kirk Foundation. And we're especially interested, as Mark said, in how you can balance your life as a corporate attorney and a political and legal commentator. That's got to be a very unusual feat for any big law partner, for any attorney. So the second thing is we want to know what your ambitions and plans are for a University Bookman. It's been around for a good bit of time. It's a wonderful resource for both essays and reviews. I read a recent essay by Aristotle that I thought was extremely, not by Aristotle, but on Aristotle. It's not been around for that long, but it was on Aristotle and it was absolutely outstanding. So any projects that you're working on. And then last, we want to ask you a little bit about your views on legal conservatism at the moment. So from our perspective, at least, we see a lot of ferment in American conservatism right now. Mark and I tend to focus on American legal conservatism, but we're kind of curious to know how you read the situation and what your predictions are about what might be coming down the road. So first, Jerry, just let's get into your background. Just describe a little bit about yourself to us and your work.
Great, will do. But first, I definitely want to thank you both for inviting me to be on this podcast. And it was one of the highest honors of my intellectual life to be part of Tradition, since that is something that I have thought about for a long time. And it was nice to be around a bunch of people who knew far more than I did and listen to them and learn from them. And also very happy that both of you have contributed to the Bookman. So my background and how I got to the Russell Kirk Center is a pretty movable and maze-like a little bit. I grew up in Brooklyn with a family that was mostly and is mostly school teachers and Con Ed workers, and whose older generations didn't foresee any schooling, really. And so when I got to a Catholic high school in New York City, I was met with a bunch of people who liked to read books as much as I did. And so it was only intensified in college. And it was in college where I first heard Russell Kirk's name. And I had, I didn't really know I was a conservative or anything in particular, but I knew that I liked my family and loved my family and loved where I was. And I thought that that was important. I heard in the 1970s and 80s, people who would attack what I now call localism, but think that people should go off and disappear from their families, lose their faith. And I found in Russell Kirk someone who didn't believe that. And I found in other people like John Henry Newman and others that we read, that a real source of literature that I would read and believe in. And I met Russell when he came to DC for a couple of lectures and began to read his works very thoroughly, and grew to like them all. And in
when was that, Jerry? When was that, when that happened?
So that was, let's see. So I graduated high school in 1989 in New York, and then 1993 in college. And interestingly, that was the time of a war in the Middle East. And so I got to really confront where should conservatives be? And Kirk was one of those people that, you know, didn't like the big state casting war all over the world. And that stuck with me, as did a number of Kirk's thoughts about this topic. One of his topics about global war was about it destroys culture at the in America, because it takes thousands and thousands and thousands of people away from their homes and then tries to bring them back.
Well, that's interesting, Gerald. And we're going to talk a little more about your background in Brooklyn, because I think it informs your conservatism. But so, you know, you told us how you got to know Russell Kirk, and how did you get involved in the Kirk Center? I mean, here you are, I assume you're practicing law, big law, and doing all that kind of stuff. And then how'd you get involved with the Kirk Center?
Well, I got involved with it because as a college student without any money, I was begging for book reviews so I could have the books for free and write about them. And I started writing as a junior. I came out with a couple of book reviews and essays in a magazine called Crisis. And I found a magazine called The University Bookman, which was in hard copy. And I started begging them for books to review. And Russell, who was then the editor, let me. And so I was always connected with the Kirk Center for a while. And when I was in law school and I started to want to write a book on Russell, a conservative think tank, Heritage, gave me money to go visit his house, which was the summer after he died, to spend some time doing research on him. And so I became very close to the Kirk Center. And when the previous editor, Russell's son-in-law, had to move on to another job, asked me to carry it on, to hold on to it for a while. I had thought I was taking it on only for a couple of years, but this is now the 20th year that I've been doing this. I offer my resignation every year or so just to give them the option that this is mine to own. I'm holding on to it for the purposes of others. But that's how I got connected with them, that it was through writing for them and meeting Russell and then staying in touch with them since then.
And what kinds of things does the center do, Jerry? You know, can you give us a sense of sort of the range of the programs or offerings or activities that the center runs?
Oh, sure. First, it's magnificent because it is the only conservative center based in the conservative thinker's house. It's where he lived. It's where his library was. It's where he brought guests. And when you go there, you can't help but avoid seeing the physicality of Russell's conservatism. You could see the trees that he planted. And so they invite people to the house to see the library, to walk through the grounds of his what's called Piety Hill. And they have a couple of things on that campus, and also what they call Kirk on campus, where they send thinkers and have symposia at college campuses, which is a very good initiative that the Kirk Center has started. It has also invited teachers to the campus or to its campus in Mecosta, Michigan, which has maybe 600 people in it, to learn about American government principles that they've started. In addition to the University Bookman, they have a journal that comes out a couple of times a year that's more academic than ours on Edmund Burke and his times. And then they're also connected with other societies, like there's a society called Law and Society that has conferences there. So they are a center of a number of societies, as well as the initiator of a number of its own initiatives, which are on campuses and also at Mecosta itself.
Got it. That's very interesting. And so the University Bookman, just to ask you briefly about that. So that project obviously is mostly about reviews, you've told us. Are there any sort of plans that you have for it? You know, what would you like for it to become? Would you sort of like to kind of maintain it and be its custodian for a little while? Or do you have new projects and things that are involved with it?
Well, my dream is for it to become the American version of the Times literary review of books in actual physical format. But for now, I think we are going to keep up generally what we're doing. We have a couple of things that we've done recently and will be doing to have more focused symposia on a book or on a topic. So we did one on John Courtney Murray. We have one coming up on religious freedom for a different book. We've done a number of interviews of Bookman contributors whose book is just coming out or will be coming out that have been very successful. We did one on Gracie Olmsted, who wrote a book called Uprooted, which I found very interesting because it describes what happens to young people who have a sense of tradition, nevertheless have to leave the home of their generations. What happens to them then? And that one was luckily enough seen by someone at C-SPAN and put it on their book channel. So we have had some more exposure. And the third thing that we like to do and will continue to do are publishing reviews of books not in English that are important, that either won't be translated or have much, or it's unclear or when. So we've been doing that in for a number of different languages that I hope to continue, because one of the Bookman's models when Russell did it was Eliot's Criterion, which also did that. And so we're trying to keep that connection as we go through. And there are lots of very interesting books being published in Europe that may never see the side of this the Atlantic. So we're hoping to get it.
And Gerald, how do you manage all this? I mean, you're still practicing law. You're a partner at a big law firm, doing very high level stuff, lots of high pressure stuff. How do you manage to do all this?
I don't know. My joke is that I'm happy with anything that's mediocre, and we'll keep moving on it. But as you know, big law does not let you be mediocre. You have to be perfect. The answer, I think, that is true is, and I have three kids who are now teenagers, but once were not, is that you give up a lot of other things when you want to do things that you think ought to be done or that you're obligated to be done or that you love to do in response to other things. So you can ask me any question you like about any contemporary sport, and I will not know the answer, although at one time I did. And the same goes for general television and other things. So I spend a lot of time on my legal work, which obviously is first, but for writing or for reading or for assisting in the reviews and commissioning them, that's my second thing. That's what I do on the train.
And what about your own writing? Let's just sort of move a little bit to that, Jerry, now. So We know it because we follow you. In fact, I just saw a piece in the National Review that you had on a book on Kirk, but your range is actually very broad. I mean, it spans politics and sociology and American culture and literature and many others. So is there a discipline that you particularly, and of course law, right? Is there a discipline that you like writing about more, or that you have sort of plans to write about in the future?
Yeah, I think that how I go about it is one of the reasons my range tends to be broad is first because I started out as a sort of grubby freelancer because I wanted to be in, when I was 19 or 20, 21, I wanted to be in every magazine possible because I thought that's where I was going. Instead, I went to professional law school and was practicing. And so I took that as an opportunity that despite not being the classics scholar that I wanted to be, but was instead a practitioner, I didn't have to write in just the classics as I would have had to be as a scholar. So I can now write upon anything that I wanted because none of it counted for me professionally. Other things did. So that was why I chose to write in a lot of different ways. And also because, you know, with as I'm sure I know the two of you do too, I have a pretty broad ranging curiosity about things that I don't know. And so when I want to learn something, I pick a book and ask someone if I can write about it. And so the things that I like or have liked over time are conservative theory generally, because it was, as I was getting older, attacked so much, I wanted to understand whether those attacks made sense. There's a British historian named Christopher Dawson, who I got introduced to upon leaving high school. My favorite teacher gave me a couple of his books and said, "You must read these." And so I did. And my first book was an edited collection of Christopher Dawson's work. And I like that his work related people to him. And that led me to other topics that I liked. I like British Catholicism, so I'll do things on that. And the law, worked. I didn't and don't write about anything that's current generally, but I like understanding what the law is, law theory, and where it might go.
Gerald, I wonder if we could turn now back to something you said before about your upbringing in Brooklyn, because I think it has something to do with your kind of conservatism. I think it's important to how you look at things. You know, you write movingly in First Things magazine. You wrote a while ago about your upbringing there, and you've reflected on your desire to stay close by as an adult, to remain near your roots. And this is an unusual position in our culture. I mean, staying close to home, especially for the professional class of which you're a member. And I would say even for conservatives. I mean, you know, you were talking a little while ago about Russell Kirk. You can see the trees that he planted. And, you know, that's not really a big thing for American conservatives these days, sticking close to the trees that you've planted. I think that's a special kind of conservatism, which is yours too. It's a rooted localist conservatism. And as I say, this is a minority position in our culture, even a minority position in American conservatism, which I think prizes mobility. You know, you go where the taxes are lower and where the jobs are plentiful. So I wonder if you could reflect on that a little bit about what localism says to you, how it affects your particular brand of conservatism, and how it differs from other types of conservatism.
Well, thank you. My brand of conservatism is definitely derived from my experience living in New York and does come intellectually from Kirk and was formed when I got to college because the two forms of conservatives I met there didn't appeal to me. One was, you come from New York, you can't possibly be a conservative. There aren't none there. They're in this big city that has industry or bad culture, and so you should leave. And the other version was people who had moved from their hometown where their generations lived, where their families lived, because they wanted to change the world. Now, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. If you have a vocation to do something and you have, and your place where you live doesn't provide it for you, but you need to think thoroughly about it. And so as I was thinking about leaving at the end of my college career, going to graduate school and becoming a classics professor, while close to my heart, could have led me anywhere. And that's not somewhere where I wanted to be. I wanted to be close to my family, if possible. And so I went to a law school, and I knew that New York City, you may know, has jobs for lawyers. And so that's where I went. And on an intellectual level, reading Kirk, I understood that humans are tradition-rooted animals, and I wanted to enhance mine and extend mine another generation with among my family and among the places that I had grown up and had taught me. And I was very lucky to meet a wife who also is from New York City, because that doesn't always happen, and so you have to choose. But it's something you need to think about. And so that's really my conservatism. It's a localist one. And New York has, as you both know, has many, many neighborhoods. And if you look at them as Reaganites, that's looking at them the wrong way. Are you looking at them as rooted communities, which is what matters to a conservator, should.
So why do you think, I'm curious, and by the way, I very much admire your conservatism. I think of myself that way too. It's not a podcast about me, but I think about myself that way too. Why do you think American conservatives, by and large, reject that form of conservatism?
I think because many of them are, in fact, not fully conservative. I think that there's a very heavy emphasis on individual, even in American conservatism. And so, and also a very heavy emphasis on policy, on politics, that attracts people to Washington, which is where the power is. And that's what I think attracts most of them. And what's lacking, and what I have tried to write about, and how I positioned Kirk a little bit, was that, okay, that's fine, but you still have to build tradition where you are. You can't deny it. That's how people interact. That's how people understand meaning. So if you're going to leave where you're from, go to a community that will help you, that you can help, that your children will understand and defend, because wherever they go, they will then understand that tradition is worth having. And that should also, at least in my view, and this is very personal, it wouldn't apply to everybody, would also let you understand the kind of community you are from, what ethnicity, what faith, where do you live? And so do not reject those, because the current culture wants to strip you of all of that. And if you just become a conservative policy person or policy or a conservative big money person, you may lose all of that. And then you'll become a liberal by the end of your life anyway.
Can I ask, Jerry, number one, it sounds actually, and I think there are a lot of affinities with Roger Scruton's work. And Scruton, we actually had, Sir Roger Scruton, we had as one of our tradition project speakers for the second leg of it. He also talks about rootedness and other forms of local attachment. But I guess the question that I have for you is, but of course you're, and I don't think I'm saying anything that I shouldn't be, you're no longer in Brooklyn, right? You moved out of Brooklyn. And so I wonder whether you think the kind of project of rootedness, at least with respect to certain communities, whether it continues to be possible, whether it's possible in a place like Brooklyn, for example, or possible in other communities in the New York area or otherwise?
Well, I would say a couple of things. First, since this interview is about me, I could say that Scruton quoted me once in one of his books, which delights me to no end. And meeting him at Tradition was one of the best things that has ever happened to me. To answer your question, there's two things going on. That first, there are communities that can dissolve around you. And so the one I was living in Brooklyn became very difficult for the other conservative or communitarian values I wanted to inculcate. So a lot of the people in that neighborhood were not from there. They came there for a big job or a job of some kind and would move out 5 years later. And so there wasn't a lot there that you could point to as something that lasted for a long time. And secondly, at a higher level than just my tradition instincts, was my faith. It was difficult to raise children as Catholics in that neighborhood, which was very secular. And so I found a town that looks like and feels like the neighborhood in which I was raised. And so it was a way of doing both, but and also putting them in the right, at least for me, which is not for everyone, the hierarchy of what was important. I didn't like to be the father who was known for taking his children out to go to mass, taking them out of school, and they were the only ones. When those two things mix, for me, there was one that was more important than the other.
Yeah, that's fascinating, Gerald. I mean, it's so interesting talking to you about these things. I want to talk a little bit more broadly about the divisions in contemporary conservatism. So now you and I have just talked about a little bit about this with Mark, about kind of a rooted conservatism versus a more individualistic or market-oriented conservatism. And I think a big divide in contemporary conservatism is between classical liberals, maybe you'd call them right conservatives, I don't know, right liberals, classical liberals, and I don't know what you'd call them, common good conservatives, right? And the fusionist project that people talked about, 50, 60 years ago, the National Review Project, seems pretty shaky right now. And I know you've thought about this. So as an observer of contemporary American conservatism, how do you see that division? Is there a way to fuse these different strands, or like your neighborhood in Brooklyn, has that moment just passed?
I think that the moment might be passing. I had written a piece called Can We Patch Up the Right? And my implication is that probably not. When people refer to the right, there are still enough of us who remember the 1980s, where the sacred tripod were the libertarians, the anti-communists, and the cultural conservatives. And as it turns out, that only works if the underlying culture is healthy. And the conservatives did not win that battle. That, depending on different metrics, we live in a much less conservative culture than we did in even 30 years ago. And so to have certain of the other parts of conservatism be helpful is a little unclear to me, because libertarians, while they have some good arguments and good points, don't seem to have the right fit, the right argument now, because a lot of Republicans or conservatives of various stripes have seen the need for government action. And Russell Kirk wrote about this a while ago, that although the culture is what's most important, it can be reflected in government action. And a lot of conservatives just don't like the government. They want it smaller. But that only works if you don't have an overweening culture that doesn't like you, that doesn't like tradition, that doesn't like a common good, or likes it in a way that's not helpful. So I think it needs to be reformed. I think that there are gaps still to be filled out. I think that Kirk is a common good conservative, but not in the way that some of those proponents are saying now. And so we need to think about, well, what does it look like? Does it look like a government that knows what the common good is, pressing it upon the people, or does it come out from the other direction, cultural initiatives that build the basis for having such a government action? And do you want one? The common good folks that I have read, I seem to have forgotten the Federalist, or thought that the Federalist system doesn't work. And I'm still, perhaps because I've been around too long, still a little attached to a Federalist, even if you're not happy that the common good, as you understand it, is not being implicated in 50 states all at once. It's still better to start it small. And I think those people, those conservatives, the ones who both think that culture counts and that government can be used to further the common good, will be the ones that survive, not the anti-socialist conservatives that you hear from time to time, not the what used to be called the neoconservatives, most of whom have left the right, but who want to who want to develop American military rather than talk about common culture.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, Gerald, I wish we had longer to talk now. Maybe we'll have to bring you back for another episode because there's so many interesting things that, that you brought up today. But thanks so much for coming. We really enjoyed hosting you. Come again, now that you know the way, now that we got our recording set up.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been a real honor.
Oh, you're very welcome. So that's it for this episode. We'll be back next time. But for now, this is Mark Movsesian and Mark DiGirolami from St. John's with another episode of Legal Spirits. Take care and see you next time.